Up next from O'Reilly Media's MySQL Users Conference, it's a presentation by Adam Bosworth entitled Database Requirements in the Age of Scalable Services from IT Conversations. Hello, this is Doug Kay, the executive producer of IT Conversations, and today I'm excited to bring you another presentation from O'Reilly Media's MySQL Users Conference, held April 18th through 21st, 2005, in Santa Clara, California. IT Conversations audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. And now, here's our presentation from the MySQL Users Conference.
We do have a lot of companies that we're working with at MySQL. Some are famous, some are infamous. Some we decline their existence. This company's name is Google. Some of you guys are using it right now. And they have a ton of good people over there. They have a ton of great software and doing good things. And of course, also in that crowd is a gentleman named Adam Bosworth.
So I was amused to hear about people using Microsoft Project. I always viewed it when I was at Microsoft as this secret weapon that was used to stop everyone else from being able to compete. not that Microsoft would do that, of course. The other thing I was thinking as I was listening to that incredibly high-energy talk that preceded me was, why do these conferences start so early? I don't know about you, but I've been a developer all my life. And as far as I can tell, I don't think I've ever woken up on a normal day before about 8:30. So this business of having conferences that start at 8 o'clock or 8:30 is completely bemusing to me. You know, I normally get up, I have my coffee, I have a little smoked salmon, I read the paper, I sort of think about life, I stare blankly into space while I assemble myself, and finally around 9:30 or 10, I drag myself into the office. So when I'm asked to give a talk at this hour of the morning, I'm feeling slightly fragile to begin with. But all developer conferences do this. It's sort of some sort of giant masochism. The second thing I noticed was that when this prior talk began to run late, they brought up the lights and turned off the video. It reminded me of an old movie in which a jockey is found dead in one of the Thin Man movies. And when the jockey's found dead, it said he's fixing races. And Myrna Loy says, boy, they're tough in this town. And I figure they're going to turn me off if I'm late, so I better hurry up because I've got more slides than time. What I want to talk about is something that I've actually had on my mind for about 10 years. I've been at Google for about 10 months, so clearly this precedes the Google talk. Though I will admit that I went to Google in part to help realize what I'm about to talk about. The talk is something that I noticed and got excited about 10 years ago when I finally started paying attention to the web about sort of 2 years after everybody else did. In 1995, I woke up from a sort of Microsoft-induced narcoleptic coma and realized there was this thing called the web and got really excited about it because all of a sudden there was a thing where anyone could get to any data or anyone at any time. And this seemed pretty cool. And I had been building a whole bunch of stuff at Microsoft at the time, including databases, Access, and those infamous ADO things and various other pieces, and building a lot of UI. And all of it suddenly seemed profoundly irrelevant to me. I don't want to get into an argument with Mono, but I suddenly decided that the idea that I could have zero install applications was astonishingly useful. And the idea that the applications could be accessed from anywhere at any time without me worrying about what PC I had was astonishingly useful. I sort of view the PC very much the way I view my phone. It's a useful cache of the latest data that I've got and a useful access point to what I care about, but it's not actually the place I store stuff. So what I want to talk about is what this means for everyone in this crowd. But in order to do that, I want to talk about how did the web happen? People take it for granted. You just assume that there's always been the web. You know, in the beginning there was the web and the web was good and so on, but that actually isn't true. When Tim Berners-Lee came out with HTTP and HTML, it turned out that he sort of hit a perfect storm of efficiency. He made something really simple. And because it was really simple, virtually any what I call P programmer, by which I mean Perl, Python, and PHP, though in those days PHP wasn't quite around, could build stuff that actually generated web content. That was a heck of a lot easier than, for example, building those very cool-looking mono apps that we just saw. Building a really simple form that came up and said, here's a list of the tasks that you have due today, was something that virtually anyone who could think could put up on the screen. And then if you we came along and built something called IE4 and had this cute idea, which is sort of like this delayed seven-year time bomb, which is now ticked off, that the client could actually help, that you could move data up to the client and then you could use intelligent code. How many people here have seen Google Maps? So Google Maps is kind of fun. How much fun? I don't think even Google realized until we put the satellite stuff in the other day, and we very nearly shut down for bandwidth. And we have a lot of bandwidth. It appeared that virtually every human being on the face of the planet decided it would be cool to go to the maps, put on the satellite view, and then start dragging around and see what they could see. And you'd be surprised how many pictures actually get surfed up when you do that. It's more than we expected. But so simple was huge because it meant that everybody could play. The other issue was sloppy. HTML is really sloppy. In fact, when we were building IE4, we had this very simple mantra. It doesn't matter what you give us, we will render it. And every so often we'd sort of choke and we would stare at something and we'd go, no, we will render this. If table rows overlap table rows, we'd render. If TDs intersected with forms, we'd render. We didn't care. Basically, the general theory was it takes a licking and it keeps on ticking. And because we did that, it meant that people could be very flexible and very sloppy about how they generated their content. They didn't have to be sort of high priests of syntax. You've never gotten an error that says, I'm sorry, we cannot render your page. The HTML is invalid. Now, you do actually occasionally get that on phones with XHTML. And it's not what we call a good user experience. But the other issue is, again, because it was a very sloppy standard, a lot of people who otherwise maybe couldn't have authored content could author content. That was a very empowering thing. The third issue was that it was a standard. That meant it ran everywhere. And it particularly ran everywhere because it was easy. And so everybody who had Linux and didn't like Microsoft could put it on Linux, and everybody who had Unix could put it on Unix, and everyone who had Mac could put it on Mac, and everyone and so on and so forth. Making things that are easy and sloppy causes them to run everywhere because there's a lot of smart people who can just go and build them everywhere, and they did. But the fourth issue, which is actually the subject of today's talk more than the first three, is scale. I was making a joke just now about bandwidth, though not a complete joke. It actually did use up a third of our bandwidth. But the scale that's possible on the web today is just astonishing. The number of hits that can hit a single interesting thing when it gets slashed out, it is overwhelming. And the amount of data that gets served up is incredible. And the numbers that they represent dwarf what we in the database world used to think of as really big numbers. And there are four reasons this was possible. Number one, partitioning. There's this thing called DNS. I don't go to one place on the web. There is no centralized web. Now, I bring that up because databases aren't so good at this. One of the things that the web does is it distributes the information across God knows how many machines. We have quite a lot of machines. But we have a small fraction of the world's machines. It's bigger than you think, but nonetheless a small fraction. And the web works because it's served up from everywhere. And partitioning, DNS, is what causes that to be possible. The second thing is caching. We were looking the other day at what were the hot hits just on our blogs. And a couple of them became very hot briefly. And suddenly there were 120,000 hits in 1 second on one blog. Now, 120,000 in 1 second is actually a lot, it turns out. And the only reason it worked was because there were about 18 zillion places caching it all the way across the web. There were proxy servers caching it, front ends caching it, our own front ends were caching it. If they'd all gone back to the same database and said, fetch this thing 120,000 seconds, in fact, times a second, the spindle would have melted. And, you know, that isn't what happened. And then there's stateless. And I'm not going to belabor that because I think everyone here understands why that's important. But there's one thing that I think was actually missed on the web, and it's generally pointed at as a defect by the rich client crowd. Coarse-grained interactions. The web, in fact, is usually dismissively said as, oh God, we're going back to that 3270 standard. The browser-based model was one where when you talk from the client to the server, you talk in terms of a chunk of data. It's not that every time you type a key or drag the mouse or click on something, you cause a reaction to go to the server. You go to the server when you're good and ready. So instead of having maybe 1,500 or even 5,000 interactions per second with a server, you have one or two. That's a huge difference. Servers, it turns out, are just fine at dealing with fairly large numbers of things per second. So if they wanted to support 1,000 users and the users are doing, say, one thing every 5 seconds, the servers can do that. But if the users are doing 5,000 things a second and they're trying to support a few hundred users, it doesn't work nearly as well. They basically break. So having coarse-grained interactions really mattered. Now, this fairly simple recipe had an incredible effect. We really do have information at our fingertips. And it's not just us. It's not just Google. You know, whenever I want to look up a book, I automatically go to Amazon and look up the books, or I go elsewhere. If I'm looking for what's for sale, I automatically go to eBay. Virtually everybody I know is now using some sort of an online CRM, so when they want to look up who are their prospects or their customers or what do they know about their customers, they go to Salesforce. The information is coming on very fast. And one of the reasons that this is so profoundly effective is not just that the software was there, but the hardware was there. I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation the other day about what $1 million buys you. At Google, we buy fairly cheap machines. They're about $2,000 per machine at most, actually a little bit less. And the machines tend to be fairly big. They have 4 gigabytes, and they have a bunch of disks. And so I sort of rounded up and said, okay, what are we actually getting for $1 million? And it turned out we were getting roughly 2 terabytes of in-memory data. Well, 2 terabytes of in-memory data is a lot of data. 2 terabytes covers most things. And you'd be surprised. I mean, even the 30 gig of photos that came up would cover a lot of photos. So terabytes are big. You're getting a petabyte of on-disk data, and you're getting about 50,000 requests per second, or about 1 billion requests a day. $1 million is incredibly cost-effective today. And yet, if you go and look at the database world, and you say, oh, I spend $1 million of hardware, and I get a database, and I put the database on it, will I then have 2 terabytes of in-memory data, and so on and so forth, and will this thing just scale so that I can automatically support 1 billion requests a day? And the answer is no. How many people here have built a system that takes 1 billion requests a day? Well, you could. And actually, that's the point of this conversation, or what I want to talk about. It's the same thing that's made Google possible. I mean, think about what Google does. We get hundreds of millions of fairly hard queries a day. The queries tend to say things like, I'm searching, for camels in Tanzania, or Tanzania, whatever. And, we sort of shake our head and try and figure out what that means. And then we go over petabytes of content. Not terabytes, but petabytes of content. And we have a couple of 100 milliseconds in which we're allowed to search the entire petabytes and return back to you what we found in rank order. So not only are we trying to search really, really large amounts of data, we're trying to search it extraordinarily quickly, and we're trying to do this hundreds of millions of times a day. And we do it. And we do it without a hell of a lot of sweat. The way I think about Google is it's like lots of PhDs driving tanks. It's all about brute force. Everyone's sort of General Patton. They don't drive around the wall, they drive through the wall. It's really dumb techniques used in large scale. I mean, for example, the spell checking. Every so often when you're typing a Google query and it will say, did you mean? And it's usually because you put in a typo. This is not because we have some incredible dictionary or some brilliant thesaurus that tells us what you meant. It's because we've been tracking what people typed after they typed a query that didn't return anything. And it turned out that that was a very efficient way to figure out what you probably meant to type. In fact, it works much better than any spell checker. But notice the stupidity of the approach. Oh, people who type this usually wanted to do this. Works great. It turns out that the hardware is there, and the strategy for software is there to deliver this kind of scale. When you do deliver this kind of scale, when you can search really large amounts of data with low latency, it changes how you think about data. I mean, photos are a good example, but virtually anything is. Once you can just search, this whole business of organizing things into folders starts to diminish in importance. And the problem with folders is you can't remember which folder you put them in. I was talking to some guy at Google the other day who can only be described as being anal compulsive to the nth degree. He has a folder called school, and inside that folder is a folder called college and a folder called high school. And inside of the college one, he has a folder called freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior years. This is a true story with all the stuff that he actually sent or received during. I can't even imagine doing that. I mean, the organizational skills are impressive, but of course it means that if he's searching in any of the myriad of other ways he might care about searching for that content, he's not going to find it. And he won't even remember. Who remembers what you did sophomore year versus freshman year? So folders are not a very efficient way to find things. Searches are. So once you have searches, this can be an extraordinarily fast and effective model. So the vision for you to think about is, can we take what you've already been using, can we take a database, and can we do the same thing for the web that was done for content? Can we serve up a web of data? Can we take all the information on the web, all scientific information, ecological information, every task, bug, tracking system, every optimistic Microsoft project schedule that said, here are the tasks and the dependency graphs, everything that you'd want to know, my daughter's fencing schedule and PTA schedule, and you know the project I'm working with some people on bioinformatics, can we take all of that data and make it easily findable by anyone? You might say, well, we've already done that. That was called the web. But we haven't done it in a way where you can actually search for information and get back information. What you get back is content. And trying to infer information from content is trying to look at people, you were just in Brute, trying to look at people in kebabs and figure out whether they really were cute or not, you know. It's not necessarily an easy way to figure out the information. In order to do this, we need a model that sort of does for information what HTML HTTP did for the user interface. We need something that makes it easy to scale massively and linearly across the entire web. In other words, if you guys go out and start building some information in MySQL, and it turns out that more people need more of it, you should start buying 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 machines if the market is there, and the thing should automatically and effortlessly scale to use 100. And then if it turns out that you need one in Europe because there's a network latency, you stick another 100 there and it keeps scaling. You need one in Asia, you stick another 100 there, and so on and so forth. And then after a while, you start federating because you don't actually have a special expertise, so you have some other data that you're looking at, and it still scales. That's the vision. That's the one I've been working on for about 10 years. I wrote a memo that's actually available on the web somewhere about it. And I wrote a memo once at Microsoft called Sea Urchins, where I said, think of every site as a sea urchin with lots of prickly spines of useful information coming out of it. Imagine that as you find these urchins, you could ask for the intelligent information. Not that you could go to their website and say, what does it look like? But say, what is the task? What is the schedule? What do I know about these activities? When are they happening? Where are they happening? In ways so that you could then do, you could see them in the context of a calendar, or you could see them in the context of a map, or you could find the things that were available for you if you flew into Dallas for a day, assuming there are things available to you. I shouldn't say that. I'm flying to Dallas tomorrow and spending the night there, so I'm sort of wondering, what will I do? So all of these of ways for finding information is the thing that I've been looking at doing. Now, originally I had this bright, very naive idea. We would do this using XML. We'd build this text grammar. It was simple. It was sort of like HTML. We'd make it as simple, as flexible as possible. We'd sort of do it over HTTP, and that would solve our problem. The problem turned out that what we did is we created a Tower of Babel. The big difference between HTML and XML is that there is a single HTML grammar. Any browser talking to any website talks one grammar, HTML. So the websites just have to support one grammar, HTML. And that works really well. However, if every website starts serving up arbitrary XML, the browsers don't really know what to do. They actually can browse the XML, but that's kind of low calorie. You know, that's not a very useful way to deal with the information. And the things that are getting the information, while the thing is self-parsing, don't usually know how to think about it. They don't understand it, and the schema is so complicated that the average PHP developer reading the XML schema spec turns and runs out the door and has a sort of stiff drink. So this vision didn't occur. It didn't occur for a variety of reasons. It didn't occur because the XML query, which was part of the vision, took way too long. We kicked off a working group to say, let's make it easy to walk up to these sea urchins and ask questions of the data, like how many tasks are going to occur next week, or where am I going to be next month, only to find out that it took them over 4 years to produce a spec called XML query. Anything that takes 4 years is probably not worth doing, sort of a general maxim. It's better to do things in 6 months and then start learning from customers. If it takes 4 years, you've over-designed the thing. The second thing is it didn't work like the web. The web is all about starting small and simple and flexible and easy, but the schema and the query languages were huge and complex and very inflexible. So people said, boy, this is hard. Why would I do something that's hard? And then they would, to actually support this, let's imagine I walked up to you and I said, support a website, and supporting your website shipping up a set of bugs, and support this general purpose XML query language on top of the bugs. You'd look at me like I was crazy. Or maybe you turn to the MySQL guys, and I was warned not to say MySQL. I've had several meetings with my SQL because I'm a technical advisor, And most of the meetings involve large amounts of Russian vodka and something called salmiakki, which has to be tasted to be experienced, but it's basically licorice mixed with Finnish vodka, while Finns grin at you inquiringly while you drink it to make sure that you're a real man. And and so most of it's been pretty informal. But one thing that we have never agreed that my SQL should do, now that I've been briefed, is support XML query. That would just be silly. It's a big, really complex language. Then there was this thing called web services. And web services started out as a really simple idea. I'll send an XML message to you, and you send me one back. And that seemed like a good idea to me at the time. And then I got the AWS addressing spec, and the AWS policy spec, and the AWS transaction spec, and the AWS reliable messaging spec. And I've tried to read them. And after a while, I also ran out of the room and had a stiff drink. So that didn't seem like a good, simple, small, flexible way to start. Why did this happen? It happened because the people who were working on these specs are big institutionalized companies trying to protect themselves. The people who really control these specs are people like IBM and Microsoft. And they were big, deliberately, frankly, in my opinion, making something hard. Because if it was hard, only they could deliver technology to do it. What I think we want to do is just the reverse. So what I want to talk about now is what we should do. Let's see. So in order to talk about, I wanted to just talk briefly about MySQL. I've sat there and listened to all the tutorials on Monday, and what I heard you guys doing was you were basically pushing MySQL to be Oracle. You were pushing MySQL to add stored procedures because real men have stored procedures, and you were pushing them to have views because real men have views. And you're pushing them to have triggers because, needless to say, real men have triggers so they can pull the trigger on the gun. But all of this is basically about centralizing the processing logic in the database. To be blunt, centralizing processing logic in one computer or even a small number is usually a really bad idea. It doesn't scale. What has caused the web to work was not centralizing logic. What caused the web to work was you basically wrote some piece of front-end hardware that none of us really understood, but we trusted Cisco or Level 3 or whatever to give us, and that routed it to as many machines as we could find, and if things got slow, we added more machines. In short, we decentralized logic. So centralizing logic, while I understand that you all want it, and for some things it's going to be very useful, is by and large not going to give you scale. In fact, it's going to give you what we can only call anti-scale. And I said, suppose you think about it the other way around. Don't think about what to do because you want to be Oracle. Think about what to do because Oracle itself isn't nearly big enough. Because Oracle itself can't deliver on the kinds of queries I was talking about. Oracle itself can't deliver on billions of questions a day over very large amounts of data. So think about the question somewhat differently. Imagine an open model for what I'm about to describe. Not for open source, but an open model for how you get at data. So what does open mean? Open means two things to most people. If you go to the average customer and say, why do you like open source, apart from what I'll call the zealots, there are typically two arguments. Number one, I know what I'm getting. Why do I know what I'm getting? Because I can read the source. Now, I have to say, I've counted all the people who actually use open source, who've read the open source, and I'm not going to report the percentage, but it's smaller than you think. But then, nonetheless, they like the idea that they could read the source. And some of them actually do read the source. Once in a while, you even get someone who checks something in or tries to the source, but that's even more rare. But the idea is that at least it's open, and the other thing is that if it doesn't work, they can usually hire someone to go fix it. After all, it's their source. Anyone who's ever dealt with a large institutional enterprise company where you needed a fix understands the value of that. Instead of waiting for them to decide it's 2 or 3 years later and they should get a release out that does the fix, you can fix it in a day or two. So that's actually a good thing. So transparency is clearly a reason. The other issue is lock-in. Lock-in says most people conflate open source with standards. They basically are trying to avoid lock-in. They're trying to make sure that if they didn't like the provider, they can go get another provider. Obviously, ultimately, the provider can be themselves because it's open source. But people are trying to avoid lock-in. So what's not open today in the database world is how you talk to the database, the actual wire protocol. In other words, if I go and walk up to all these places that have information all over the web, I don't have the equivalent of HTML. I don't have a standard simple wire protocol that I can use. So that it doesn't matter whether I'm talking to my SQL or Oracle or whatever, I can just write this client that's talking this really simple protocol. And if I were open, it's currently not a standard. This has really been a major blocker. What MySQL has done is they've created many different storage engines that using an API can go and talk to their query engine. But it isn't something where anybody who has any information that's available and just wanted to let MySQL query it could just serve it up and instantaneously and effortlessly MySQL could do that because it would be an open standard. In other words, MySQL's query engine is not to anyone who has data as the browser is to a website. Meaning that the average PHP programmer can go and build a website and serve up pages that the browser can then consume. But the average simple, you know, like my son who's sitting writing PHP because he needs to get an app up and running, is not going to go and write a storage engine that he can feed into MySQL that it could just use and that they could find and discover furthermore over the web and that could be massively decentralized. Now, I think this is a very 20th century way to think about things. I think the lesson of the last 10 years is that you open up your formats and your data directly through wire formats that are easy and simple and flexible. And when you do that, you get a huge, huge increase in what's going to happen. I think that if we do this, if we make it as easy as I just said to serve up information where the query engine of MySQL or anyone else who writes it, or some other things that I'll talk about, can serve up any kind of information, whether it's products or used motorcycles or the books that I have in my garage, or some auction, or you know the things I think about restaurants in New York City, that my, or that a group of us think about the restaurants in New York City, or anything else you think of. If that information is effortlessly available, that's going to change how you think about what you do, because you're no longer just going to be querying your tables. You're going to be able to query any data that's available anywhere on the web, and you're going to be do it as easily, or actually more easily, I would argue, than you can query your tables today. If that happens, just as we saw an enormous change in computing between 94 and 2004, which was basically the web, I think we'll see an equally big change in computing around data. In order to do this, we're going to need an open format for items. We're going to need to say that whether it's listings or project reviews or tasks or schedules or books or motorcycles or whatever, there's some standard simple way that you could feed these things up. And it's going to have to be one grammar because otherwise the query engine that MySQL or anyone else or Google builds is going to have a very hard time with it. It's going to have to be sloppy because otherwise the average person's not going to be able to figure out how to do it. It's going to have to be easy to serve the information up because otherwise there's no point. The whole point of this argument is that we're trying to open up and democratize how data is served up to the query world. And for that matter, updated, though I haven't gotten there yet. And it's going to have to scale. Now, the scale turns out to require something that's going to cause everyone in this room to walk out of here after my talk thinking, what was he smoking? I am a big believer in stupidity. On my blog, adambosworth.net, I frequently talk about the virtues of dumbness. You can go read it for yourself and decide whether I know what I'm talking about. But I believe that complex things tend to break and simple things tend to work. And I believe that really simple things work amazingly well. Now, I put my money where my mouth is. I went to work for a company that has probably the dumbest query language we have ever seen in the Western world, actually in the world. You type in some words. There is no language. Think about it. You go to Google and you type in some words, and we try and guess based on those words what you wanted. There is no structure, no syntax, no grammar, no language. There's just some words. But it's cheap, it's linear, it's fast, and it scales across the web. Now, today, there is actually something like this coming out, and this is the point of how this actually can happen. I talked for the last 10 minutes about how we hadn't realized the vision that I'd had 10 years ago, but we actually are starting to realize this vision, and I don't know if everyone in this room has been keeping an eye on it. How many people in this room know what RSS or ATOM are? Well, that's very encouraging, but about half the hands didn't go up. For those of you who didn't raise your hand, it's time to go find out. Because there's every possibility that both RSS 2.0 and ATOM, and I'll talk in a moment about the differences, are going to be to data what HTML was to content. They're going to be the lingua franca that we use to consume virtually all data from everywhere. It's a surprisingly simple model and a surprisingly complete one. I'm going to talk about it in a second, so I'm actually not going to go into it here. It's sloppily extensible, to put it mildly. It serves you up a set of items. Think of them as rows. And it gives you some things, think of them as fields, that you get for free, like title and description and who wrote it and when was the stuff written or updated and what useful related data could you find and what kinds of tags does it have anyway. But then, and is there an attached file, and if so, how big is it and what MIME type is it? But in addition, it lets you stick anything else you want. So for example, if you were looking at books, you might want price. If you were looking at bugs, you might want priority and assigned to, and so on. And you can just stick this stuff straight in. So it's a completely extensible model. These guys got the web. And because they got the web, this thing is taking off like wildfire. Originally, it was started to be used both by the news community and the blog community, but by now, for example, Flickr, which was mentioned earlier, serves up RSS, and most people are starting to serve up RSS. I'm going to skip past this in the interest of time, because while I'm not down to my last 8 seconds, I am down to my last 8 minutes. But there's a cheat sheet, just very quickly, saying the only differences between Atom and RSS. Atom was formed by a consortium of bloggers, largely due, in my opinion, to an unnecessary political argument. But a consortium of bloggers got together and came up with sort of an alternative. They're isomorphic, and virtually everybody in the world who can read Atom can read RSS 2.0 and vice versa. They both have things called authors, but in RSS, they're just text. In Atom, it tells you there's a thing called a name, and if you want an email, and if you want an URI, and then, of course, you could stick your own things in. And has a thing called date, but they're formatted differently, which is just nuts. And a URL in one case is just a URL inside of the text, and in the other case, it actually says what kind of a URL is it. And in one case, for text, it can be rich text or not. You don't know. That's RSS. In the other case, it actually says, oh, this is XHTML text or plain text or what have you, which is a little handy. So the key idea is this is very simple format. The Atom API had one other advantage. It doesn't just let you ask for data. In other words, most of the RSS models, you give it a URL and they give you back some data. And this is how we get blogs, it's how we get the latest posts, it's how we get pictures, it's how we get news stories. These days, it's how we get book listings. And for how many people here know about A9 and the Amazon's open search RSS? Now, that was a much smaller percentage of hands. So I'm just going to talk briefly. Amazon announced something called Open Search RSS a couple of weeks ago. And what Open Search RSS is that their query engine will actually go, you can give it a little thing and say, here, if you give me a query in a URL that looks like this, I'll give you back RSS. And if you do this, they will incorporate it into their search engine. They will let you, therefore, show your used motorcycles or your books in your garage or anything else you want to be searchable. Now, not everyone is going to want to search for your used motorcycles. So they have a model, which frankly I think needs some work, for how you decide which things you want to search over. But they provided a model for directly plugging any data you want in. And I'm here to tell you that any programmer that can write a web page, apparently this is a tougher town than the prior speaker. Maybe it was the content. Anyone who wants content and to author content can do this. If you can write a web page, you can serve up the RSS feed for Amazon. What the Atom guys did is they also said sometimes you'd like to actually change the data. You might actually want to put in a new motorcycle. You might want to delete a motorcycle because it's already been sold. You might want to actually replace the motorcycle descriptions because it turns out that it was hit in a large car crash with a smart car, and while the smart car did worse, the motorcycle is still damaged. You know, whatever it is you want to do, you may want to be able to do backwards. In short, you may want to have something that's not a read-only database. So there's some extensions that we would need even over Atom, and we've been looking at them. But this is a very, very simple way to talk about things over the web. I just mentioned this. This is the Amazon thing. Basically, you give them a little thing and you say, here's the URL to give me, here's where you type the text words, and here's how you say which page I'm on and how many rows I want, and then they'll automatically feed that into their UI. That's it. That's what they give you. That's the query string you get in the GET. And then what you give them back looks like this, and this turns out to be RSS. And since we skipped over this, just briefly, RSS is typically a channel that contains a set of items, and items typically contain title and link and description, and these things here if you need them. So, suppose that we actually built a model where everyone presented their information this way. It was an open source stack where we encouraged anyone who had information to serve up the information. And when I say anyone, that includes us, meaning Google. Anyone who has information to serve up the information in this way, to make it globally available. There's still an issue. How do you massively distribute this thing? How do you cause it to scale? Now, it's easy enough to come up with a basic model. The basic model is I send you in a query, and that scales because I send it to any of any very large number of machines, and the query goes in as a URL, and then there's this HTTP model for either getting RSS or asking you to change the RSS. But the queries have to be limited. You can't go and give a query to people that says, I want to find all the items that were sold by someone who came last Friday and was hired by me on the 5th of March and isn't actually a felon. Because the average person who can write a web page can't actually solve that query. They can solve the query that says, I want all the things that have the word foo in it, because they can use some text indexing software or something. But if you make the query hard, they can't do it. So it's got to be easy to implement. The other issue is distribution. I mentioned earlier that the thing about the web is partitioning. Partitioning means that if I give a query and one machine would bottleneck, I put the data on two machines. If two machines would bottleneck, I put the data on four machines. Four machines, and so on and so forth. But in order to do that, the queries have to be queries that don't need the data across machines. If the query needs data from all four machines at once, that isn't going to work very well. Let me repeat that. In order to scale these queries linearly, the queries have to be able to be queries that you can run just on the data that happens to be on the machine that you're at. And since you can ultimately split all data across all machines, that means they have to run at the item level. Now, if they have to run at the item level, they're not going to be as rich as SQL. In particular, they're not likely to do joins. I need to compare rows. They're not likely to aggregate. I need to add rows up across things. They're not likely to do subqueries. I need to compare rows, and so on and so forth. These are going to not be queries as you know them. They're likely to be things that say, I want to find everything that has an author called Fred, or I want to find everything that has Fred, or I want to find everything that was entered in the last 6 weeks, or I want to find everything in the following date range. It's a very different model. If we don't do that, it won't scale. So the kind of querying I'm talking about here, and this is why I said you're going to walk out thinking, what is he smoking, is a much lower tech query, but it is one that virtually everybody can support. It is the HTTP and HTML of data. The model that this thing does says, okay, now if I'm a PHP programmer or Java programmer, I catch this query. Remember, the query is trivial. I'm only operating at the transaction level, so worst case, I'll just fetch all the items I've got, and then item by item, just compare. Let's see if it meets the query. For updates, we have a very simple model. We basically say, if you want to let the thing be updatable, you use a field that's already in the Atom and RSS world called the GUID, the Globally Unique ID, and probably some kind of a CRC32. To use the MySQL version of this, that you would round trip. The semantics are going to be up to the machine. Some machines are going to say you can't update data if the CRC32 has changed since you last read this item. Others are going to say, no, that's cool, I'll just create a new version. Others are going to say you can't update in the first place. And that's just and because you're distributing this data again across the web. But that's like the web today. If you go into an arbitrary website, it doesn't always mean you can do a form post. That's up to what authentication authorization you have. So some won't support delete. So, what you won't have, again, is you won't have complex conditions, and you probably won't have update. You'll have replace. Why do I say that? I'm out of time, so I'm not going to explain why I say that. So the idea, very simply, Zach complained to me that I had no diagrams. So I have two really hideous diagrams just to make Zach happy. Really hideous diagram number one is this one. Basically, when you come in with a query, it's going to go out to one or more partitions, and those partitions are going to go and ask one or more machines for the data, because often you'll duplicate the data as a result of the query, and they're going to send that back, and then it will send it back to you. Notice that this works because a query can be sent to each and all machines because the query only operates at the item level. If you try and change data, on the other hand, you're going to send in a change request, which is going to go to only one machine, the one that owns that item. And that machine is then going to send you back what happened. Either your changes were accepted or your changes were denied. So one model scales linearly across caching, one with slaves and one doesn't. And that's like anything today. But if we do this, if we build a model where virtually everybody can consume this model of extended RSS, and people like MySQL start supporting this, or we work with them to deliver this kind of feature, you guys can be Google too. You guys can handle hundreds of millions of queries a day. You can scale up and out in ways that Oracle could only dream of. You can effortlessly support hard questions where you search the entire web for restaurant reviews and report the ones that were interesting about a place and a time and by people you cared about, because you can write your own intelligence as you consume this data. In short, the technology you've been using so far to solve the problems for an individual company with their data, you can now apply to search asking questions about any data anywhere in the world at any time. I'm going to skip over the hard issues. What makes this possible is really simple, sloppy, highly scalable protocols. HTML and HTTP did this for the user interface. I believe that RSS 2.0 and Atom can do this for data. There's some things we would need to add. A formalization for query, which we're looking at just doing an extension of what Amazon's already done, and a standard model for replacing, annotating, archiving, and inserting new items. But when this happens, I think that the big centralized databases that right now I feel like sometimes MySQL is trying to compete with will be completely passe. We will speak about them just 10 years from now as being those strange things that never really got the web. And instead, the open model, open not just in the open source model that MySQL is today, but open in the protocol model that will replace it, will change the world. Thank you. So, I'm going to be late for a flight, but I can take one or two questions. The question, as best as I can paraphrase it, is if Moore's law is already driving down by an order of magnitude the cost of disk and the cost of memory, is there really a scale problem? Is that the question? So the comment was Miguel had 30 gigabytes, actually, of photos from Beirut. The bigger issue is suppose there's lots of Miguels out there. And suppose I now want to start querying for all the people who have tagged something as whatever it was Miguel tagged as photos. And I'm doing that across the entire web. How do I do it? And that's the point that I'm really addressing. I'm saying that it's not, I don't put them all in one database. I don't go to everybody in the world, including Miguel, and say, oh, all of you have 30 gigabytes of photos. Please put them all in one centralized database, because if I took a billion people and asked them to put 30 gigabytes of photos in, I believe that's 3,000 petabytes. And 3,000 petabytes is 3 million terabytes, which is, if I have my math right, which is a really large amount of data. And and you know, the average database isn't going to deal well with 3 million terabytes, even today. On the other hand, if we distribute this, so instead I can go simultaneously to all of the machines like Miguel's and ask for questions of what have you got that's tagged, and tag was one of the things in my query, then I solve that problem. Next question. I actually did mention the semantic web, but I ran out of time. I said two things, or actually three things about the semantic web. It's in the slides. Number one, I said this is not the semantic web, and I actually put it in capitals. I did the equivalent of shouting. I don't understand top-down ontologies. I don't understand invariant ontologies. I don't understand how every... I've never been able to get people within one company to agree on the scheme of one thing. So how I would get 7 billion people to agree on the scheme of anything is completely beyond me. So I've specifically said this is not some sort of subject-verb-object or semantic model for navigation. The semantic problem is still yours. All I said is I'll serve up those pictures with tags. You have to figure out if the tags are talking about the same thing, if ME means Maine or means Maryland or whatever the heck it is. So the second thing I said about this semantic web is RDF actually has failed empirically the test of simple and easy and flexible that I described. So it's flexible enough. But the average person, and we can see this in a very simple way, RSS 1.0 was an RDF grammar. RSS 2.0 was not. RSS 1.0 was a standards-based thing supported by everybody. Everyone had come together. There'd been a long group growth. They'd all talked about how pure and simple and wonderful it was. RSS 2.0 was one grouchy guy like me, sort of a difficult guy, grew up in Brooklyn, New York, who went off in a hissy fit when it wrote it down. RSS 2.0 won in a walk. And it won in a walk because virtually any programmer in there who can breathe can figure out how to emit RSS 2.0, and all of them get confused about how do you model stuff as arcs and nodes and verbs or RDF grammar. So I didn't mention it because, frankly, I'm a huge skeptic. Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation delivered at the O'Reilly Media MySQL Users Conference, April 18th through 21st, 2005, in Santa Clara, California. IT Conversations audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. IT Conversations is listener-supported, so please contribute to our tip jar. 100% of your donation will go to our team of volunteers who produce these programs for you in their spare time. The series producer for IT Conversations coverage of the MySQL conference is Arun Tonksali. The website producer for this program was Jim Alateris. Post-production audio by Bruce Sharp. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.